one of these names were. I know the most.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Matthew Blittner. To my left is co-host Daniel Green, and to his left is our once again special guest co-host Walt Bonet. And in case you didn't catch our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com, this is Outside the Studio. So, for the next 57 minutes, please sit back, relax, maybe get a drink, and enjoy some hot and cold sports takes as we have a loaded lineup here for you today. Quickly, we want to recap our Super Bowl picks from last week. The big game, of course, the Buccaneers won. They beat the Chiefs. No one thought it was going to happen except Walt, who wants to claim that he is God's gift to the world because of it. I'm going to step aside while he...
I am.
Okay, I'm going to step aside while he decides to tell us why he is such, and then Daniel and I can crucify him for it. So, Walt, get us kick-started.
Thank you, Matt. And just for some clarification, we actually had a three-way tie when it comes to points.
Oh, now you want to be humble.
That's just background. However, I would like to say that I am the winner, because predicting who wins the game is the most important. No one predict the Bucks except for me, making me the foremost expert and predictor of our time.
You got 1 point to five.
I mean, this is like the Jets bragging about beating the Rams. This is sad. None of us did well. But one thing that I will say that was captured on our show is that we asked Mike Vaccaro, if there's a way that the Chiefs are going to lose this game to the Buccaneers, if there's any scenario where it happens, what will it be? And he called it on the show. He said, well, if the line doesn't hold up because of the injury to Eric Fisher, the Bucks will win this game. And that's exactly what happened, along with a great game plan by... for some reason, former Jets coach Todd Bowles, who we, of course, fired for the legendary Adam Gase.
A horrible, horrible move. And as we alluded to before, the point system was, of course, 1-1-1. We each got 1 point out of five. Daniel and I hit the over on the national anthem prop bet. Walt did get that the Bucks would win. He did not get the score. Otherwise, that would have been the tiebreaker. So it is a three-way tie. So there is no bragging rights in that regard, regardless of what Walt wants to say. No, I'm gonna mute your mic in a second. And so Dan did win the entire playoff betting. He won 13 points to 12 against me. Walt was not here for most of the playoffs. So unfortunately, he does not qualify in that regard. So Dan, congratulations. I'm giving you the one hand clap right now, congratulating you on taking home the playoff championship. You've won a 30-cent gift card to Visa.
Can we just clarify for a second that no one cares how long the national anthem was? No one cares
that's
what color of Gatorade,
that, right?
People care who won the game, and I predicted that, making me Nostradamus of the week.
It was the lowest watched Super Bowl in 15 years. I don't think people cared about who won the game.
No one predicted the Bucks would win. No one. Except for me and Mike Vaccaro.
I think there were a few other people. You know, Vegas did have to pay out a decent amount of money, so I don't think that you'd have that quite right there.
And ultimately, it's all about the points. And it's all about the fact that I knew, and as did Matt, that duets go longer. So everybody who took our sage advice about betting on the fact that the Super Bowl... By the way, they dragged that out. How crazy was that? They went wild with dragging that national anthem.
The over-under was 159. I think they went like 218 or something.
Did
like
Eric
that.
Church bet on it? Like, what was happening there?
I think Eric Church shaved those minutes.
You can think whatever you want. Nostradamus, you are not... We're going to now get past the Super Bowl because that is old news. We're going to move into our New York Knicks, New York Knickerbockers. It is a Knicks town. I know the Nets are the so-called darlings of New York. They are winning. They are supposed to compete for, if not take home, the Larry O'Brien Championship Trophy at the end of the season. But the Knicks still get the mainstream press, and that is why we are talking about our New York Knicks, who just reacquired Derrick Rose the other day for Dennis Smith Jr., plus a 2021 second-round draft pick. Rose, it's as I mentioned, it's his second tour of duty, and this could be very good or very bad for the Knicks, so which one do you want to take this?
It's actually very different the way that I see it. The first time that Rose was here, it was much more of a boom or bust type scenario. They were putting a lot of hope on him. In this scenario, there's low risk. I mean, we've seen what Derrick Rose can do, and even in his first game back, he got 14 points in 20 minutes. He's at the point in his career, he's not the young man that was the youngest person to ever win the MVP. He's somebody who can add a veteran presence, can be a solid player, and can help the Knicks get into that expanded playoff. And it's a good move, and it's not a crazy high risk, actually. It's not going to turn out really well or really bad. It is actually a reasonable move by them.
You're right. There's absolutely no risk, and this is something that we've been concerned about. The Knicks are a very young team. Sure, they got a little bit of age with Taj Gibson, but now with Derrick Rose, they really have a veteran who could help these young players. And let's not forget, Derrick Rose still has some muster in him. He scored 14 points against the Miami Heat the other night in 20 minutes, which is good. And my only concern was that he was going to take away minutes from Emmanuel quickly, and that hasn't happened yet.
Well, he's going to be an excellent mentor to quickly regardless of whether he takes the minutes away or not, because as you mentioned, he was one of the first. He was the youngest MVP at one point. So these are all great, great things for the Knicks to be able to have in Derrick Rose. And it's not just Derrick Rose who the Knicks should be excited about. Again, there is quickly to be excited about. RJ Barrett should become more and more as he continues to play. Mitch Robinson hopefully will continue. Julius Randle, I know he's had a couple of bad games, but he's been very good lately too. The Knicks, they can't score consistently, but they're coming together as a team, and we all know that good teams become great teams, not because of their talent, but because they are better than the sum of their parts. We saw it in the late 1990 Yankees. We saw it in the 2009 Yankees. We saw it in the 07 and 2011-12 New York Giants. We've seen it in a lot of teams. You've got to be better than some of your parts, and Daniel clearly wants to say something because he's trying to put his hand over my mouth.
I completely agree with what you're saying, Matt, and what you're seeing more than, you know, the day-by-day moves and the fact that they lost to the Heat the other day is that they were competitive with the Heat, and that all comes back to Coach Tom Thibodeau and the job that he's done and getting this team on the right track, and if Rose adds to that, God bless him.
He's really making this such a positive culture, and just for some of the younger Knicks players to look at is Tom Thibodeau clearly shows loyalty to players that he's coached in the past, willing to give Derrick Rose and Taj Gibson a chance. So some of these younger players like Obi Toppin or Emmanuel Quickley can see that if they play hard and try their best for Tom Thibodeau, then he will pay it forward later on in their career.
Well, we'll see if it gets paid forward at any point soon, as the Knicks will play the Wizards tonight at 7 o'clock, so make sure you catch that. We are going to move into our first guest. We did an interview yesterday, or rather, I did an interview yesterday. I don't know where you two were, with former New York Ranger captain Ryan Callahan, who was driving through a desert or driving somewhere. Either way, Ryan was driving somewhere where this made for a rather interesting interview in that regard. So I'm going to let Callahan, Captain Cali, number 24 himself, take over from here, and we're going to hear his thoughts on his Ryan Callahan Foundation, as well as his exit from the Rangers, and a number of other topics. So, here we are with Ryan Callahan.
I've got to ask you, so, how does it feel to officially be retired from the National Hockey League now?
Good. I mean, it feels good. Obviously, last year, you know, due to injury, I didn't play, so I kind of got a taste of retirement, a little bit early. I knew I was done playing, but still being under contract, I couldn't officially announce it until the season was done. But yeah, it's been good. I mean, I'm enjoying some time with the family, doing a little TV work on the side, so it's been good.
And, you know, you didn't play last year, but Tampa won the Stanley Cup, so do they still give you a ring, or, you know, how does that work?
Yeah, no, I don't get a ring from Tampa. I was under contract with Ottawa. My contract was traded to Ottawa due to some money reasons, freeing up some cap space for Tampa, and so I didn't have any part of the team. But I couldn't be more excited to see those guys, you know, win after being through so many playoff battles with them.
And it must be difficult though, realizing that you know you came so close. You know, is there any part of you that regrets not sticking it out at least for the year, or at least trying, you know, somehow to hold on?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the writing was on the wall. I couldn't play anymore due to my back. So, you know, I have no regrets. Obviously, I wish I could have won a Stanley Cup through the years I played. But at the end of the day, I was extremely blessed to have the career I had. So definitely no regrets as I leave the game.
Right. And now, you know, you have this foundation, the Ryan Callahan Foundation, where, you know, you help kids and families, you know, with a chance. You help their dreams come true and stuff. You know, that they've been dealing with a lot of hardships. Talk to us a little bit about how you came up with this and, you know, some of the things that you've been able to do through this foundation.
Yeah, so when I first got to Tampa, my wife and I wanted to try to put together a foundation to help kids with cancer and help families with cancer. And my first year, we just started off with having kids at the game, them and their families. We had them up in a suite for a game, and they'd come down afterwards. I'd meet the families and the kids and sign some autographs, take some pictures. And through meeting so many great kids and great families, we felt like we wanted to and needed to do more for these kids. So that's when we started the Ryan Callahan Foundation and became a 501c3 and legalized ourselves. And when we did that, we started more programs. We started the 2-4 Club, which was kind of at the start a Make-A-Wish style program where, you know, kids and their families would be able to go on vacation and get away from the treatment center and spend some time together as a family. Our whole foundation is based on family unity and, you know, just trying to give them a little bit of an escape from, you know, dealing with the day-to-day hardship of, you know, your kid having cancer and going through that battle. So through that, it's just kind of grown through the past 6 years through meeting families and hearing stories and seeing how many different needs these kids' families had. We do a lot of financial help as well now, paying mortgages, rents, you know, monthly bills, things like that. So we've kind of grown organically, and, you know, we've helped out a lot of families and a lot of kids and have met a lot of great people doing it.
Absolutely. And, you know, you hear a lot about athletes in any sport, really, you know, always having some sort of connection with fans, especially ones that have hardship, whether it be cancer or something else. Has there been one or two cases through your foundation that you've especially come to be very close with that, you know, you've gotten to not just know them through it, but, you know, to really be there with them through everything and to then have them be an inspiration to you while you were out on the ice?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. There's probably a lot of them. You know, one that comes to mind is a kid named Tony Colton, who unfortunately lost his battle about three or four years ago now. And, you know, just seeing what he was going through for those first couple of years, we met him and his family and the ups and downs of treatments of good news and bad news and ultimately succumbing to the cancer and losing that battle. It was very difficult. And unfortunately, not all these kids can survive. And we've formed such tight relationships with these kids and these families. You know, it's hard to see these kids go through that, but, you know, at the same time, you talk to them and you realize how much it means to them, everything that we're doing, and it kind of just drives you even further just to make a difference and try to help in any way you can.
And it definitely sounds like you guys are trying, and of course you alluded to the hardships of it and to see them, you know, sometimes not make it through. That's something that no one should ever have to go through, but it is great work that you and your family are doing in this regard. And you mentioned you started doing it when you got down to Tampa. So I'm going to take you on a little bit of a time warp right now. When you first, you know, when the news was first coming out that the Rangers and you were in a bit of a contract impasse, was Tampa on your radar? You know, were you abreast of the whole, okay, these are the teams that they're talking to? And if so, you know, how did you feel at the time about potentially Tampa being the option for you?
Yeah, I'll be honest. Throughout that whole year, I didn't know. I mean, my whole focus was trying to get a deal done with New York. You know, that's where I wanted to be. I wanted to stay there as a captain there. I love the city, the fans. I mean, everything about it. That's where I wanted to be. But as negotiation went on, and you could see where, you know, it wasn't happening, we eventually came to terms on a price, but. I wanted a no move or a no trade clause just because, you know, I had a young family and I wanted to make sure that, you know, I was staying in New York or I had something to say on where I was going. And unfortunately, they're unwilling to give me that. And You know, at that point, the writing was on the wall that, you know, I would probably get moved, but it was still a shock when it came and I found out. And, you know, like I said, I didn't know where it was going to be to or who was going to pick me up, but, you know, that Tampa did, it was great. I mean, I loved my, you know, 3 months in Tampa when I got traded there and eventually, you know, re-signed with them during that summer, just because I knew where that team was going, how good they were, you know, how much my family loved the city when we got traded there. So it worked out.
Right. And, you know, there was a time right before you got traded, I believe it was 6 days or so, you had a home game with the Rangers at the Garden. I believe your opponent was Colorado, if I'm not mistaken. And you scored 2 goals in the first period, and the fans were absolutely deafening at Madison Square Garden. They're pleading for you to stay. Do you recall that game? And if so, what was, you know, what were you feeling, you know, just seeing the outpouring of emotion from New York fans for you?
Yeah, I mean, I can't thank New York fans enough for the, you know, for the support and love that they gave me throughout my years there. And I don't remember that game, you know, specifically to a T, but I do remember, you know, my last couple of games at the Garden just as things were coming to an end, you know, and the writing was on the wall and, you know, I was trying to work out a negotiations for a contract, but they weren't happening. And yeah, I just loved playing at the Garden in front of those fans. They were so, so supportive, and, you know, I can't thank them enough. And, yeah, it was a tough place to leave, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. And, you know, over the years though, you were joined by quite a few of your former Ranger teammates. You had Dan Girardi, Anton Strowman, Ryan McDonough, JT Miller, Brian Boyle. You didn't play with Chad and Kirk when he was on the you guys weren't on the Rangers at the same time, but you had a number of former Rangers come down and join you in Tampa. You know, was that a little bit, you know, unusual to see so many former teammates join you on a new team?
Yeah, very, very unusual. It seemed like that, you know, there's just an exchange back and forth constantly there after I went to Tampa. But, I mean, at the same time, I played with a lot of those guys for a long, long time, and I knew what we were getting in Tampa with those players, and I was extremely excited to play with them again. I mean, you know, those guys came down and were part of some really good teams in Tampa, and, you know, we had a couple of good chances of winning. So a little bit unusual for that many guys to go from one team to another, you know, all in the same time. But, you know, I couldn't have been more excited because, you know, all those guys I were super close with, and I knew how good they were on the ice.
And you had the leg up, so to speak, because you had already gotten the chance to acclimate to the Tampa area, acclimate to the franchise, have your family get used to the area. So were you part of the transition process for all of them, and how did you help some of them get their families adjusted?
Yeah, absolutely. We were my wife and I, and you know, helped everybody basically that came down, and just little stuff that people don't think of away from the rink, of setting up doctors, you know, where to live, where to shop, you know, things around town. You know, you're going to a brand new city, and you're uprooting your life and moving there. So, you know, any way we could help those guys just get settled quicker and get acclimated with the Tampa Bay area, we definitely helped out with.
And, you know, was there anyone in particular that you had a, you know, very funny or fun trying to get them acclimated because for whatever reason they just kept running into obstacles?
I can't, you know, I'll be honest, I can't think of, you know, one guy that, I mean, Tampa's a pretty laid back, easy place to live, I'll be honest with you. You know, sunshine all the time. Everybody seems to have that Florida vibe and laid back feel. So, you know, it's not a hard place to get used to and to settle into.
And of course, you know, Tampa's the city of champions right now between the Lightning and the Buccaneers. You know, that has to feel great for you and everyone around there, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. I moved out of Tampa now, back in Rochester, New York, but being around that fan base and that community for so long, I know how passionate they are about their teams in Tampa, and you know, I was so excited, obviously, to see, you know, the Lightning win, but, you know, I know how much that meant to that community for the Bucks to win. The Rays went to the World Series Finals. It's pretty wild that you know, a city gets to enjoy all three teams like that. Two of them winning championships and one in the finals. So I was definitely excited for the Tampa community and, you know, getting some love for all the support they give their teams.
And, you know, now that you're back in Rochester and that you, as you mentioned before, doing some TV work, you know, what made you choose to become a TV analyst, and why go the analyst route over maybe coaching or something like that?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I was kind of open to anything, try out and see how it went. And last year when I was under contract, I had the opportunity to go do some TV work for the NHL Network and be an analyst. And I didn't know how I was going to like it. I had no idea if I was going to be good at it or if I liked it. But I went out and I gave it a shot. I enjoyed doing it. And then this year I decided to continue with it. So, down the road, if something comes up and, you know, I hook on with a team doing something, you know, I'm keeping everything open. But right now I'm enjoying doing the media side of things.
And, you know, you definitely have an aptitude for it. Anyone who's watched you and your appearances on NHL Network would have to agree with that. Another one of your former Ranger teammates that recently left the team in Henrik Lundqvist, obviously, with a different circumstance. And, of course, unfortunately, Henrik is not playing this year. You know, but in your opinion, what was it that allowed Henrik to be not only just the face of the Ranger franchise, but set him apart from essentially every other goalie? You know, you got to know him very well, so it must be something that you could say that, you know, that people don't realize that made him tick to such a great degree.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to point to one thing with him. I mean, obviously his ability in the net was outstanding, but he had a presence in the room too. With how good he was and how hard he worked, I think everybody just had such a respect for him, and seemed like the bigger the game, the better he played. And he backboned a lot of those teams that I was on that, you know, he stole a lot of games for us. So I think the biggest thing about him is he just had a respect in the room, and that respect went out and into the city as well, through his work ethic and through his ability on the ice. And couldn't be a nicer guy as well. So, so many attributes, I think, went into why what he was so special on the ice, and also why he was such an icon in New York.
Absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with former Ranger captain Ryan Callahan. Ryan, before we let you go, I don't know how much you've been watching of the current Rangers team. Obviously, they haven't had a captain since Ryan McDonagh was traded to Tampa 3 years ago. As a former captain of the team, what's your thoughts on the leadership of the team and how and them not having a captain? And do they need a captain to help them transition from being such a young team to being an upper echelon team?
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest, I'm not in that room. I mean, I watch them a ton and, you know, see what's going on in the ice. But, unless you know what's going on in that room and you know those guys specifically, it's hard to say who should be captain or, you know, if there should be a captain. And I think that's where the organization's at right now is, either they think one or two guys can be, or, you know, right now they feel like, they're better off not naming one sole captain. And, it's hard to give your opinion on it when you don't know what's going on in the room. Cause I think that's where, you know, the captain means the most is, does he have the respect of his teammates? Does he, you know, command a room? Does he bring that out onto the ice? So, without knowing what's going on in there, it's hard to say if they should name a captain right now or not. But tell you what, the way they played last night against Boston, they looked really, really good. And obviously a little bit of a bumpy start to the season, but, it's such a bright future with the young guys they have there mixed in with some veteran guys, good goaltending. So if you're a Rangers fan, and it's a team I follow closely, obviously, being, you know, a former player there, it's going to be a bright, bright future.
Thank you so much for that analysis, Ryan. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you know, please make sure to tune in whenever Ryan is on the NHL Network. He gives absolutely phenomenal breakdowns of everything. Ryan, best to you and your family. It's to the Ryan Callahan Foundation, and we certainly hope to hear from you again in the near future.
Awesome. I really appreciate having me on.
Yeah, everyone, thank you, and have a great day, Ryan.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's our interview with former New York Ranger captain Ryan Callahan. Again, please make sure to visit the RyanCallahanFoundation.org website for more details on how to get involved with the Ryan Callahan Foundation, as they do incredible work with kids and families that are undergoing just unimaginable hardships. So if you would get the chance, please check that out. Please get involved. I know Ryan would be very, very happy if he could get more people involved with it. Again, that's RyanCallahanFoundation.org. We're going to move right now into our very unique, very... you're going to get a lot of heated debate right now amongst the three of us for an NFL QB situation. For those of you who maybe have not been following the news in the National Football League, there's a lot of quarterbacks who are treating this like the world is ending, they want to be on the move, they're frustrated with their current team. There's just so many different things going on. Russell Wilson's annoyed. Deshaun Watson's demanded a trade. Carson Wentz is going to get traded. Aaron Rodgers is, who knows what's going to happen. Dak Prescott might leave. Marcus Mariota might leave. Derek Carr might leave. The list goes on and on. I haven't even spoken about Sam Darnold here in New York who might leave. I think I just named a third of the NFL quarterbacks. So, Dan, what is going on? What have the quarterbacks been drinking?
It is a two-part effect right here. One part of it is the Tom Brady effect. All of these quarterbacks watched how Tom Brady was able to carry another organization to the Super Bowl. We saw this with Peyton Manning a couple of years ago, but this just reemphasizes the point that the quarterback can make a huge impact on the team. And the other part of it is what I call the Philip Rivers effect. So Philip Rivers was somebody who, for a long time, was arguably a Hall of Fame player. And I think it would be difficult to argue that on his statistics. But what people always get on Philip Rivers about on his legacy is his team's never won and he wasn't, quote, a winner. That wasn't completely his fault. That organization blew a lot of leads. They hired a lot of bad coaches. Yet Philip Rivers is the one who had to shoulder that blame. So when you look at all these quarterbacks, they're thinking, how can I be in an organization that's not ideal for me? What can I do to put myself in a powerful situation where I can really make a difference?
So the most important player on the field thinks that they need even more power. Is that what you're saying?
And it's justifiable.
But these great quarterbacks who want to be in that better environment, I just don't think they're going to find a better place. Where will Aaron Rodgers go that fits his offense better? Where will Russell Wilson go?
Look, Russell Wilson, that was the shocker that came out just a couple days ago. I don't know where he's going to go. He's annoyed at Brian Schottenheimer being fired. He's annoyed at being sat the most out of any quarterback, essentially, which obviously falls on his offensive line and the GM for building the team. I don't know that that doesn't quite fall on Pete Carroll or anyone on the coaching staff. I don't know that that falls on anyone other than the offensive line.
But again, when Russell Wilson won the Super Bowl back in, I think it was 2013, that was the highest paid offensive line. That's what it was.
It was also the highest paid defense.
And the thing is, you look at Patrick Mahomes yesterday, you look at how important that is, and then you look at Russell Wilson's career. He's in his 30s. Who knows how long this guy's window is? So when you look at somebody like Matthew Stafford, who was destroyed, you look at Andrew Luck, who was destroyed and had to retire from it, you say to yourself, oh, I don't blame these guys. How can you blame these guys?
I'm not blaming them, but they're getting paid an awful lot of money. Or in Dak Prescott's case, he's looking to make a lot of money as he's currently a free agent. So it should be a very interesting situation to see what's going to happen down in Dallas. I don't think Aaron Rodgers is going to be on the move. Russell Wilson could be the wild card in this whole thing. And Deshaun Watson may as well just be the nuclear option for all I know.
This is just unbelievable that these NFL quarterbacks are finally understanding this bargaining power that they have. Just look at every other sport where these star athletes really understand that they can control their destiny. They can control where they go. And for the first time, we're finally seeing someone like Deshaun Watson really demand a trade. And while a lot of people are getting mad at him, it's working. J.J. Watt just announced his desire to leave the Texans. So we'll see where they go from here.
They released him today. But I take issue with the point that you just made. And the Jet fan over here in me is going to take you to task for this. You just said this is the first time that we're seeing NFL players do this. Might I remind you of Jamal Adams, for crying out loud?
Yeah, but this is so different. This is so different than that, Matt. This is a situation where it's literally a third of the quarterbacks, maybe a quarter of the quarterbacks are saying, we know that we're the stability. We know that we're literally called franchise quarterbacks because you build a franchise around us. And we want another franchise to build around us. They're taking the power into their own hands. And while it makes sense, what Walt said before, I actually have to agree. Are they going to find It's sort of like the grass is greener on the other side. It's like, are you really going to find a better lawn once you're over there?
Well, we'll see if they do or if they don't. I'd imagine Dak Prescott could find greener pastures. Aaron Rodgers and Russell Wilson, probably not so much. Deshaun Watson, depending on where he goes, might be a greener pasture.
I mean, anything's a greener pasture. That's like going on brown grass.
The Jets are not.
Low blow right there. I'm keeping tally of how many low blows you're giving out today. That's two for the record. Three strikes, you're out. And we've got so many quarterbacks here, as we've been talking about, that they want out or they're frustrated and we think they want out. So, again, Watson's the only one who has demanded a trade. Carson Wentz, I guess you could say, demanded a trade in a way. This is a weird off-season, and technically the off-season hasn't even begun because the lead calendar hasn't flipped to the next official lead year yet. So I want your guys' opinion on something. What is it that is causing the quarterbacks to say in mass that they want this going now? Okay, because this isn't, again, I know we've mentioned how, you know, the NBA does this, the MLB does this, NHL certainly does not, unless you're Patrick Laine and Pierre-Luc Dubois, but that's a rarity. What is it in the drinking water? Let's get some radical ideas in here about why this is happening now and not last year, not next year. Why now?
It's a social media impact, and it's the impact of the rise of individual star players and them understanding what they're worth and them understanding they are stars and they do deserve it. And while I don't necessarily think, by the way, any of these, it's possible none of these guys leave except for Wentz and Watson. That is a distinct possibility. But this also adds pressures to those teams. Now, Seattle has a lot of cap issues. They have only $4 million left in the cap.
So is that a competitor?
But of course, the Bucks actually have a pretty good cap situation. But what is happening is, if they don't get traded, at the very least, they'll be able to say, hey, get me some help up front. Get me an extra wideout that can really push us over the top.
Well, it's going to have made for a fascinating offseason one way or another, whether everyone leaves, no one leaves, some combination in between leaves. Again, as Walt alluded to before, the J.J. Watt situation happened probably about, 3 hours before we went on air today, saying how he went to the team, expressed his desire that he didn't want to be there, and they released him. They didn't even bother to try to trade him. They released him. Three-time Defensive Player of the Year, they outright released him. I don't know that we saw that one happening. And, you know, could the fans possibly be, you know, what side do you think the fans are going to take on this? Not just the Houston fans, but NFL fans that players are essentially in mass saying, I want out and you have to take me and do what I say.
Just before we move to the NFL in general, just to focus on these Houston fans who have suffered some devastating losses in the last 2 years with James Harden leaving, Springer leaving.
Shooting themselves in the foot, by the way. It's all their fault.
Yeah, but I really think NFL fans should treat it like an NBA fan. The NBA builds super teams all the time. That's how you get ahead. And the NBA stars are what control their destiny, what control the teams that are built. And J.J. Watt today, when he was released from the Texans, released a very genuine video to his fans saying he loved his time in Houston and he had a great experience. So I think NFL fans should embrace this just like they're embracing the other leagues.
It's a great point, Walt. And I wish we could sit here all day and do so, but we have a very special guest coming on. He is a PhD who, and let's be honest, that's probably the first time I've ever said that on this show or any show I've ever been on, that is a professor in sports ethics out in Arizona and sports philosophy. We're going to talk all about sports gambling. I'm going to let Daniel and Walt give you guys an introduction to the man known as Sean Klein, PhD. I'm going to go get Sean. Walt, Dan, take it from here.
I think this segment was really inspired by the fact that when you look on TV, sports gambling has had a massive rise. Massive. All of us. Sports gambling used to be underground. It used to be hidden. It used to be shady bookies in a back alley. Now every other commercial is, hey, you want to have more fun watching this game? Why don't you bet some money on it? Why don't we exploit your weaknesses? It's a really complicated situation, and there's nobody better to discuss it than somebody like Sean Klein.
I'm really excited for this segment, Daniel. For as long as I could remember, and probably in the entire history of sports, gambling was considered a vice, just like drinking alcohol during the prohibition was a vice. And when a vice like that is legalized, there's a lot of ethical implications. So there's no one better to discuss that than Sean Klein, who's a renowned professor from Arizona State University, who lectures in the area of philosophy and ethics, specifically sports ethics and philosophy of sports. He's actually currently editing a book series called The Studies in the Philosophy of Sport, and he's made numerous media appearances discussing the implications of sports gambling from an ethical perspective, and I think his perspective today will be really interesting for the show.
Thank you for that, Walt and Daniel. Sean, you're joined here on Outside the Studio. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
And thank you, Sean, so much for joining us here today. We're going to get this kick-started a little bit with, you know, if you can break down the relationship between gambling and the pro sports leagues, as my co-host here alluded to in your intro, this was something that, you know, they were always very much against each other. Leagues never wanted anything to do with gambling, and now all of a sudden they're not just accepting it, they're business partners, which is just mind-blowing. So what are some of the ethical implications of this? What caused this shift to change? You know, break this down for us, because this is something that a lot of people engage in and maybe don't fully understand.
Sure, yeah. So it really started to shift in 2018 with a Supreme Court decision that overturned a 1992 law that prohibited sports betting in almost everywhere in the U.S., with a few notable exceptions, obviously Vegas, and I think a couple other carve-outs. But mainly, it was illegal everywhere, according to federal law. This Supreme Court decision overturned that, allowing states to decide on their own whether or not to allow sports gambling or not. And since then, about 20 states have legalized sports betting. So the shift really comes pre 2018. It's illegal in most states, so the leagues, you know, keep their distance from it because it's illegal. And after 2018, many states start opening up for legalized gambling, and the writing's on the wall. The leagues see the revenue possibilities because of gambling and its association with sports, and have, you know, a lot of sports fans also like to gamble and bet on the games as well. And so there's an obvious marketing connection there for the leagues and for the bookmakers. And so once it's legal, they start to get a lot of marketing and partnership deals, sponsorship deals into place, as we've seen in the last year or so with several big name arrangements between the NFL as well as with individual teams. And so you see much more legalized gambling now that's going to be on the table, at least in almost half the states.
And what do you see as the full ethical implication of that? Does this lead to fixing games? Like, does this lead to other issues? Like, what kind of things do you foresee as being problematic?
Right. So that's a great question. And obviously, you identified one of the main ethical concerns here is match fixing or match interference. You don't have to fix the match. You might just shave some points or, you know, manipulate the game for prop bets or something like that without actually throwing the match or fixing the match. But any that kind of interference, so match fixing or match interference, is obviously one of the major concerns. The other concern for sure is those individuals who might have gambling problem or pathological gambling issues, gambling addiction, and so that's obviously a concern, because once it's legal, more people will be engaging in gambling, and so there'll probably be an increase somewhat in those numbers, and so that's one other concern. Now, I think, though, in terms of would this lead to more match fixing, I actually think, well, one, we don't have a lot of that in the states, in the U.S. anyway, as far as we know. There really hasn't been anything major. I mean, obviously you have the 1919 White Sox scandal, and really since then, nothing really, really major in terms of trying to
Boston
fix
college.
So you have some college sports, usually in basketball, it's more shaving of points off the point spread and things like that. And so there are some scandals, but typically, though, right, these are in regimes where it's already illegal, so it's not necessarily doing anything to stop that. But primarily, though, I think I'd make the argument that by having it legal, you're actually likely to decrease the chances of the interference. That when it's when you make it illegal, right, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, right? Be nice if by making something illegal, it would just disappear. We could get rid of murder overnight, right? But that doesn't happen, right? So making something illegal doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And so what happens is that then it just becomes in the hands of criminals rather than corporations and leagues and so on. So I think, rather than pushing it to the back alley and to the Michael Corleones of the world, it's better if we legalize it. We're going to have more transparency, and we're able to monitor it and regulate it. And the reputations of the NFL, of DraftKings, of Caesar's Palace are going to hinge on having transparent, open sports with integrity. Right, their bottom line rests. Right, Caesar's Palace doesn't want a reputation of fixing sports or having the sports fixed. People aren't going to bet on sports if they think it's fixed or they think it's being manipulated. So they
sorry to cut you off there, but people do bet on wrestling, which is fixed. So, you know, maybe people still will bet even if they know or think that it's fixed.
People actually bet on the WWE. That's just the definition of insanity. I mean, that's like going to Hamilton and betting on whether or not Burr is going to get killed by Hamilton at the end of the play or not. I mean, you know how it ends. It's scripted. So I think I'm actually surprised that you can bet on. I mean, like, on that, just because it's a known issue and there's too much. Usually, the bookmakers don't want to deal with that. Right? But they're not going to put that out there because it's a set thing.
But this actually leads to the bigger problem, and the reason that the WWE, there are bets on it, is because there's a market there. People are willing to do it. So I want to talk about some of the ethical implications for the NFL in terms of advertising towards people that may have a problem. Now, we do that already with alcohol. There's a beer commercial every 5 seconds, even though alcohol is addictive. Do you see gambling as the same type of thing, or do you think there's more there or less there?
I think it's probably less than alcohol. One, I mean, I think the dangers of alcohol abuse versus gambling abuse is probably worse on the side of alcohol abuse. But also just in terms of percentages, I think in terms of the numbers of people, the number of people that are estimated to have pathological gambling issues is really quite small given the number of people that actually engage in gambling. You know, it's something like on the order of 1-2% of gamblers, people who engage in at some level of gambling, meet a definition, a psychological definition of having some, you know, gambling addiction, gambling problem. Now, colloquially, we probably can think that number's a little bit bigger because someone might get into some trouble, but they're not necessarily, you know, having a pathological problem. So, you know, some of this is definitional. But certainly there's going to be people with problems, and I think the better target, rather than criminalizing it, is focusing on harm reduction. You know, whether it's, you know, having the availability of gambling hotlines, as well as other sorts of counseling or other sorts of programs that can help people that are going to have problems, but allowing the other, you know, 95-98% of the people that are able to engage in this activity as entertainment to do it without it really being a major problem.
When fantasy sports like DraftKings and FanDuel were lobbying the states for legalization, they tried to use the argument that fantasy sports is more skill-based than the normal betting on a game or a prop bet. Do you see the two types of betting differently, and are there different ethical implications?
Yeah, well, so that's a tricky question. I mean, there's legal concepts there in terms of how you define something to be gambling versus not gambling. Most states go by what they call the dominant factor rule. I think I got the name of that right. And basically there is, what's the dominant determiner of the outcome? Is it something that's more likely to be skill, or is it more likely to be chance? Some states, like my own Arizona, have a stronger, stricter standard, and really the role of chance, if it exists, tends to rule it out. So I can't do daily fantasy here, because there is some measure of chance. Most states, though, allow it, majority of them, I think, allow daily fantasy as not fitting the definition of gambling, because there is skill involved. And there is a skill in terms of picking your lineup, picking your players. I mean, there's certainly chance, but there is also skill. And there's ways in which you can try to look at the results to see that people that are purported to have more skills are able to win more often than those than just a random draw. And so because there's skill involved there, in terms of being able to affect the outcome in terms of your applying your skill to the situation, then it looks a lot less like gambling. Now, I think it does raise some similar ethical concerns just in terms of when you start getting into high stakes fantasy, whether it's regular old fantasy or whether it's daily fantasy, if you're talking about big money going down, you have some of these integrity concerns that could be a factor there for match fixing and whatnot. So Sean, I think you, go ahead.
Sorry, on the topic of, you know, the possible match fixing and also the integrity, I think the biggest integrity issue might be there are players, and maybe not as prevalent in Major League Baseball and the National Hockey League, but certainly in the National Football League and National Basketball Association, that they partake in fantasy sports of which the sport they're playing. You see and hear all the time of football players talking about, oh, I have such and such on my team in fantasy, and same in basketball. So is there not an ethical implication? Is there not an integrity issue that, you know, J.J. Watt, for example, might have, well, I don't know why he would choose the Houston Texans defense, if anything, but, you know, maybe have the Seattle Seahawks defense when he's going up against Seattle or something. You know, could you foresee this as being an issue? Because these players are, you know, how do you regulate that? I can't imagine there's a way to regulate it. And if the players are playing the fantasy, what's to stop them from trying to make fantasy a reality and reality a fantasy?
Yeah, no, and I think certainly when you're talking about high stakes. Now, I mean, if it's just the Watt boys on their personal team and there's no money at stake, it's hard to imagine that there's really any concern there. But when you start talking about high stakes stuff where people are putting serious money down, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $100,000 kinds of stakes or more, you know, you can get into those concerns. And, you know, I think particularly maybe for daily fantasy, because it starts to look a lot more close to gambling, you probably would want, just like you would, I think, for gambling, to have some prohibitions on the part as part of your contraction with the league, with the team, not to engage in those activities, not to engage in gambling, not to engage in you know, any kind of high stakes fantasy. You know, I'll have a definition in the contract, you know, more than $10,000 prize or something like that. And I think, you know, you prohibit that for either, you know, the players and the coaches, maybe even extend that to staff and also game officials as well. Right? The EPL, the English Premier League, does that. Almost anybody affiliated with the club, players, coaches, otherwise, can't engage in gambling. I don't know about fantasy on that end, but they can't make a bet.
But in terms of with the sports now embracing this and players partaking, do you think that it is reasonable, or do you think that it's hypocritical that players like Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe Jackson are still banned from the Hall of Fame and are still pariahs in their respective sports when it's gambling and the leagues have taken such a stronger stance on it?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think certainly those sorts of situations, we should take another look at them. I mean, I think that both Rose certainly should be in the Hall of Fame, irrespective of whatever we think he might have gambled in terms of when he was a coach and whatnot. But that's my view of the Hall of Fame. It's a museum. It's not like a Hall of Honor. It should note the, you know, I'm saying, same with the steroid users and so on. They should get in as well, but that's a separate argument. And Shoeless Joe, right? I mean, there's all sorts of stories about how much did he really participate in it at all. Now I think one issue there is that if they bet against their own team, that's really, or they even just bet on their team, I think that's pretty problematic. And I could see if that's the case, and that's the conclusion, that you keep those bans on, even if you now allow it. But I think in general, that we should go back and look at people that might be continue to be banned. I think Pete Rose is the only, and Shoeless Joe are the only ones that haven't been reinstated historically, at least big name wise. But I'd be okay with the reinstatement of them and putting them in the Hall.
And those are great points, Sean. We appreciate you very much coming on the show here today.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you've been listening at all, if you're just tuning in, we've been talking with Sean Klein. You can check out Sean's opinions and frequent blog posts on sportsethos.com and pay attention to his book series, Studies in the Philosophy of Sport. Sean, if you could leave us with one lasting message, what would that be?
Oh, that's a good question. The message I would leave you with is that sports gambling should be legal, and I look forward to it being legal.
Thank you so much, and Sean will be speaking with you, I'm sure, down the road as more sports leagues continue to envelop the gambling aspect of their culture. Ladies and gentlemen, if we can just give you a brief bit of advice, if you or anyone you know suffers from anything gambling issue related, please call the gambling hotline at 1-800-522-4700 or go online at www.ncpgambling.org, hopefully you don't know anyone who is in that, but it's there if you need it, and please use it if need be. We are going to move into our last segment of the day here, and it's a new one. We're going to be letting fans from time to time call in on the show to give their opinions, their hot takes, their cold takes, their crazy takes, their anything they want to say about sports. They're going to be given the free rein to do so, as long as they keep the appropriate language, of course. And then, after they give their take, Daniel, Walt, and I reserve the right to rate their take, and we will determine whether or not it is a good take, a bad take, hot, cold, lukewarm, and then when you guys listen, either re-listen or listen live, feel free to reach out on social media and tell us your opinions of it. So our fan here today, our lucky historic fan number one, is Alex Fine from the City of Brotherly Love. I am going to get Alex on the line right now as he is going to talk to us about his take, and hopefully it's one that won't get ridden out of the building on. So let's get Alex in here right now as we can talk to him. Come on, Alex. Alex, it's Matthew, Walt, and Dan on Outside the Studio. How you doing today?
Matthew, Walt, and Dan, good afternoon, gentlemen. How we doing?
Doing well. We hear you're from the City of Brotherly Love. Does that have anything to do with the hot take you want to give us today?
Listen here, Matty. That has basically nothing to do with this hot take. I don't even think this is a hot take, but the world keeps telling me it is, so I had to get up here on my podium and make this stance. You know, when I look at the NBA right now, there's only one guy who should be in the MVP conversation, and that's Joel Hans Embiid. Again, this is not even a hot take to me. I sell Campbell's Chunky Soup for a living. That's hot. This take shouldn't be hot in the grand scheme of things. Joel Embiid is averaging more points, more rebounds, more steals, more blocks, less turnovers a game than LeBron James. He has a higher field goal percentage, a higher free throw percentage, and dare I say a higher offensive and defensive rating as well. Once again, this conversation should be put to bed already. I know it's not even the all-star break yet, but I don't even need to see anymore. Joel Embiid, give him the trophy and bring it back to Philadelphia.
Alex, I can tell that you work for Campbell's Soup because that is a super hot take.
Oh, no. He brought out the super hot take. Oh, boy. All right. Well,
I would say that is a lukewarm take at best because all the ESPN called 100 media members to participate in an informal poll where Embiid was put number two. So that's just a pretty neutral take to me, and I still think LeBron will take it.
I'm done with the cold take here. I don't care if Philadelphia wins the Eastern Conference. The Joel Embiid is not going to win the MVP. We all know.
Look, right or wrong,
LeBron James. Look, I don't like the guy. I've never rooted for him. I would never want to see. I don't want LeBron to win his fifth MVP. I don't want that. However, there are other people who could potentially take this MVP. Joel Embiid is not one of them, in my opinion. I'm going to give you about 10 seconds right now to redeem yourself.
Matthew, you're not even speaking any facts. You're just spouting nonsense like a casual NBA fan. Anyone who looks at the statistics, who watches a basketball game, can tell you in a heartbeat, Joel Embiid is your man. Sixers, first place. Lakers, second place. They're not even ahead of the Utah Jazz right now. I don't want to hear it until LeBron steps up and plays defense in a regular season game like Joel Embiid does every single freaking night of the week. I don't want to hear it. Give him the trophy. thank you guys for your time.
That logic falls apart once the Nets overtake the East.
Absolutely. And look, Alex, thank you for being our historic first fan. We're going to touch you right now because we have more important things to get to talking about. But thank you, and we hope that you continue to listen in to Outside the Studio. All right, guys, that was something.
No, I mean, Alex makes a really good point, by the way. I think it was glossed over. Joel Embiid is a great two-way player. He's somebody who makes a massive effect on the Sixers, both offensively and defensively. Now, is Joel Embiid going to stay healthy for the whole year? Knock on wood. Is Joel Embiid somebody who could end up falling apart later in the season? It's possible, but right now, Alex pointed to all the facts, his offensive efficiency, his defense. This guy's on top of the world right now.
He also probably has the weakest supporting cast of any of the top MVP contenders.
He could have a weak cast. He could have a strong cast. We all know that the media, and I guess that includes us at this point, is in LeBron's pocket, is in the Lakers' pocket. As I said to Alex, I don't want LeBron winning his fifth MVP. I've never rooted for LeBron, not even during his first tour of duty with the Cavaliers, before he spurned the Knicks with his decision to go to South Beach. It's just, I don't like the way the guy plays. I know he's an all-time great, but I just don't think Embiid has what it takes to take home the MVP this year. Maybe in future years, he's just not going to get it. Right or wrong, he's not going to get it this year, and that could be a bad thing, that could be a good thing. We'll see. I want each of your takes right now on who you think beyond Embiid and LeBron could be potential MVP candidates.
I mean, Jokic is the other guy that could probably take it home. But again, I think it's going to be either, especially if the pace keeps going the way it is, it's either going to be LeBron or Embiid. LeBron's in his, you know, having still an unbelievable year. He's shooting 41% from three-point range. He's, you know, he's averaging 25 points, but it's hard to ever vote against LeBron, isn't it? So that'd be, yeah.
All right, I have a hot take, and that's Giannis. Giannis is literally carrying the Bucks on his back, and toe-to-toe with any other player, including Embiid, he stands up in the statistics perspective.
Well, Walt, thank you for taking my pick from us, but I guess it's going to be two against one here on Outside the Studio, as I'm also going with Giannis, and I would not be surprised if he takes home his third straight, I believe, if he takes it all home. So it's going to be an impressive sight to see as the MVP race, as well as the race to the championship, continues to go through over the next couple of months. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have for you today. If you miss our live show, you can always catch the recording on NewYorkExtra.com, Spotify, Podomatic, iTunes, Apple, SoundCloud. Please tune back in next Friday, February 19th at 4 p.m. for more hot and cold takes. Once again, I'm Matthew Blittner. To my left is co-host Daniel Green. To his left is our special guest co-host Walt Bonet, saying thank you for tuning in. And if you enjoyed our theme song by Jessica Page Demary, please visit her website, jdcompositions.com, for her full works. And we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio.